Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM. It's Caoimhe Hearney with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Cathal Berry, Independent TD for Kildare South and former Deputy Commander of the Army Ranger Wing. The future of Ireland's air defences is up in the air. Then we'll speak to Dr. Sheila Gilheeney, CEO of Alcohol Action Ireland. The Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, has signed into law new regulations which will require all alcohol products to state their calorie content and the number of grams of alcohol in the product. Owen will speak to Scott McNamara, manager of Newbridge United's under-17s. Newbridge United will be representing Kildare at this year's Foyle Cup in Northern Ireland, and that's taking place in July. And then last, we'll speak to Michael Guerin, addiction counsellor. A drug testing regime introduced at Electric Picnic in October will be rolled out to different types of festivals this summer. If you want to get in touch with the show on any of the issues that we're going to raise, 045 898 999 is the number. If you want to email me, it's studio@kfmradio.com, or you can send us a text or WhatsApp.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, you may have heard this over the last couple of weeks, but Ireland's inability to defend its own airspace has been in the spotlight, with the revelation that it has relied on the RAF to fulfil this role for the last 70 years. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Cathal Berry, Independent TD for Kildare South and former Deputy Commander of the Army Ranger Wing. Good afternoon, Cathal.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe.
Cathal, you're definitely the man who would know all about this. I suppose, give us the lowdown first on what this really means, because it might sound like gobbledygook to many of us.
Yeah, so I suppose the first thing is that Ireland's airspace management is very, very poor. We've very, very busy airspace over our heads, but it's kind of like the Wild West up there. It's very, very poorly managed. And that's the first point I'd like to say. And secondly, that this is not normal. No other EU country conducts its business like that. So the third point is that every single EU country has what they would call its primary radar coverage over their airspace. So they can see all aircraft, whether they're helicopters or whether they're drones or whether they're commercial aircraft or whether they're sports aircraft, whether the aircraft had their transponders turned on or not. So of the 27 EU countries, Ireland is the only country without this capability, and it's something we have to improve on as soon as possible.
Okay, so no air defence capability of any significance basically means that we are relying solely on the UK. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And it's not the way to do business for a sovereign, independent country that's been around for 100 years. And again, this is not normal. Every other EU country, bar Malta, has what they would describe as an air policing service. So you quite rightly mentioned that we've no way of defending our airspace. And that's true. In wartime or in times of conflict, you're expected to be able to defend your airspace. But in peacetime, which is the time we're in now, you're expected to be able to police it. And unfortunately, we have no air policing service at all. And that makes us unique in Europe, with the exception of tiny Malta.
Okay, so Cathal, if we were to make these changes and be in a position to defend our airspace, what do we need to do and what changes do we need to make right now?
Yeah, well, the first thing is to have primary radar coverage of our own country. And in fairness to the government, they've made an announcement 15 months ago and that they do wish to have primary radar coverage of the country. And that would require pretty much three radars deployed around the country, probably one in Donegal, one in Kerry, and one somewhere in the Midlands. So, like everything, announcements are great, but we've had absolutely no implementation since. So step one is basically implement a government decision from 15 months ago, and that we get our primary radar up and running. And then secondly, we do need an air policing service. Again, we did have one in the past. Up to about 25 years ago, we had Fuga aircraft, and they were capable of doing some low-grade subsonic interventions, but unfortunately, we've no air policing service at all. And we can set one up for quite a reasonable cost. And in fact, you could set up an air policing service in Ireland very, very soon, and for half the cost of the search and rescue contract. So the search and rescue contract, these are the four red and white Coast Guard helicopters you see flying around Ireland. That costs about $65 million a year. You can actually set up an air policing service for approximately half that cost. So it's well within our reach as a rich country.
Okay. I suppose these issues have come to the fore, I imagine, Cathal, in the last year or so because of the invasion of Ukraine and then, you know, NATO, etc. Like, I suppose the question is that many people will be asking is, if we were to be, you know, and I know it's hypothetical, but if we were to be invaded tomorrow, what is our situation? Like, how would we fare?
I think anybody with a military bone in their body would say that we're practically defenceless, that our military has been not resourced for the last 100 years, but particularly wound down in the last decade. So I remember going to Chad, and many of your listeners might actually remember it as well, but there was 10,500 people in the defence forces only 10 years ago, and now there's only 7,800. So there's been a 25% drop in personnel. And if you were, for instance, if we reduce the number of nurses or doctors or teachers in the country or guards by 25%, it would have massive, disastrous consequences for both society and for those organisations. And that's exactly what's happening in the Defence Force at the moment. The few people that are left have been absolutely flogged from a work point of view, and that's creating this vicious cycle where people get burned out and exhausted, and in turn they leave themselves. So we really need to retain and recruit more people and get the numbers back up to where we were 10 years ago as a first step.
Okay, retention and recruitment there at the fore then. So I suppose, Cathal, the question is, would you be in favour of a significant pay rise for members of the Defence Forces?
Absolutely. And the main reason, well, one of the reasons would be this. The Defence Force personnel, they don't have access to the same industrial relations machinery as other employees. So Defence Force personnel, for instance, they're not allowed partake in any form of industrial action whatsoever, but crucially they're not allowed to have any access to the labour court either. So what this means is this is the one group of people in the entire country that need direct government intervention periodic to make sure that their pay is at least on a par with other parts of the public sector as well as the private sector. So there needs to be a government intervention here, because again, alternatively, if you don't want to have a government intervention, then give our troops and their representative associations access to labour court, and give our troops access to industrial action. Now, I wouldn't like that to happen, and most people, the vast majority of people in the Defence Force, wouldn't like to have to resort to industrial action. So the simple answer is it needs direct government intervention to make sure the pay rates are appropriate.
Okay, why don't the Defence Forces have access to the Labour Court, Cathal? Is it something that's, you know, across the EU? Is that standard?
No, and I don't really see the reason why they don't either. Now, the Labour Court is generally regarded as a court of arbitration in the course of industrial action. So most people who go to the Labour Court will be on strike, so maybe there's a connection there. But if the military are not allowed to strike, and I agree that should be the case, they can at least get access to that. They should be allowed to get access to the Labour Court, because the Labour Court do issue rulings and the government do accept Labour Court recommendations. And it's a big point of disadvantage when the representative associations from the Defence Forces, PINFORA and RACO, when they go in to negotiate and they do collective bargaining, basically their hands are tied behind their back, because the negotiators on the far side of the table, they know the guys can't strike. And as a result, they take full advantage of that. So I suppose the key message I'm trying to get across is to ensure a level playing field, direct government intervention is needed from a pay rate point of view to ensure fair play for the members of Defence Forces and their families.
What is the level of pay at the moment, Cathal? Let's say, a guy comes out of school, he wants to go into the army, wants to go into the Defence Forces, goes in, does his training, he's in and he's being paid. What's the level? What does it start at?
Yeah, great question. So there has been some moderate improvement in the last 12 months in particular, which is good. So people with less than 3 years service, there's been significant improvement. It's about 35,000 after 6 months of training, which is good money if you're doing a 40-hour week. But the problem is doing an 80-hour week would not be unusual in the Defence Force at all. So the basic pay is okay if you've less than 3 years service. But any kind of overtime or any kind of additional hours, the pay is paltry from that point of view. So the additional shift allowances that firefighters or nurses or guards would get, they're not applicable to defence forces on, and that's really where our troops are losing out. The pay rate is okay for some doing 40-hour a week, but again, many of our troops will be doing twice that, and they don't get the financial recognition for those additional hours, and that's where the problem lies.
Okay. Just to circle back to what you were saying there earlier, Cathal, about the if we were to set up our own air defence and it was 30 million, are they figures that you have costed yourself, or where is that figure coming from?
Yeah, they're professionally costed, for sure. You can lease aircraft. It's actually South Korean aircraft, which would be, I suppose, their advanced trainers would be the best description for them, but they can be armed and they're capable of supersonic flight, and they can be leased over a long period of time and for around that figure. So it is very, very manageable. And as I said, there's good reason why every other EU country has this capability, because it's absolutely vital. Like we saw only last year where an aircraft was flown from France to a little airstrip in Longford full of drugs. And these are the aircraft, for instance, that we hear about. And as a general rule, you detect about 10% of these types of aircraft being in contraband. So for sure, we know for sure that there are aircraft landing in Ireland with the transponders turned off, and we've no way of actually monitoring them. And we also know then that from Spain and Portugal, that these narco subs are being used to transport narcotics from South America across the Atlantic and to land in Europe. Now, we've no evidence whatsoever of that happening in Ireland, but the reason we have no evidence most likely is that we have no means of detecting these submarines. So as you'd always say, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. So for sure, Ireland really needs to up its game from a defence and security and from policing of the air point of view. We really are bottom of the class at the moment, and people in the rest of Europe are concerned for Ireland's well-being, first of all, but also that if Ireland is being used as a base to attack them as well, they're very, very concerned from that point of view.
If it's going to cost maybe 30 million less, Cathal, to go down your route, which seems to be the better option, why are the government not doing it? Is there no political will there?
There is some political will, but if we go back to the primary radar, that was quite a simple decision. There's no legal impediment to it. There's cross-party support for it. A decision was taken 15 months ago, but there's still no implementation. And my own personal view, and I think that view is shared, is that we do need a standalone defence minister. So we do have one at the moment. But he's there in a part-time role. He's also Taoiseach, he's also part leader of Fianna Fáil, he's also Minister for Foreign Affairs, and in addition, he's Minister for Defence. So no matter how good you are or how motivated you are, you physically can't do all that work in a single 24-hour period. There's actually legislation provides for a Minister for State at the Department of Defence, so a so-called junior minister. And we do actually have one. Most people don't know who it is. So it's Peter Burke. He's based up in Mullingar. But he has no powers delegated to him whatsoever. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is you do need proper political governance in Newbridge every single day of the week, either a senior government minister or a junior government minister, and their job is to lift up the bonnet and to drive change and find out where is this project, why isn't it done, I need it done by Friday, all the day-to-day governance that takes place in KFM, no doubt, and takes place in every GA team and charity up and down the country every single day of the week as well. But unfortunately, it's not happening in the defence apparatus, and it needs to happen. We need proper political governance to drive these reforms.
All right. Cathal Berry, independent TD for Kildare South and former deputy commander of the Army Ranger Wing. Thanks very much, Cathal, for joining us. And I know many people in Kildare maybe are members of the Defence Forces or have served. And I'd love to know your position on what Cathal spoke about there, maybe your experience within the Defence Forces. 0833 97 97 97. Now, many of you may have heard over the last couple of hours, I suppose, that news breaking that the world's first comprehensive health labelling of alcohol products is to be signed into law by Health Minister Stephen Donnelly, and it will contain warnings about risks of liver disease and cancers from excessive consumption, and that has been signed into law. It'll take effect from the 22nd of May 2026. I'm joined now on the line by Dr. Sheila Gilheeny. She's CEO of Alcohol Action Ireland. Good afternoon, Sheila.
Good afternoon. Now, I have to say I'm just having a little bit of difficulty hearing you there. Hopefully the line won't drop here, but thanks very much for having me on.
No problem at all. Hopefully we'll be able to keep you on the line there, Sheila. I suppose good news from your end, Sheila, that in Alcohol Action Ireland, I assume that you think this is a good thing.
Yes, we absolutely do welcome, you know, these this legislation finally being enacted. This is, you know, very minimal information, but very important information at the same time, where, you know, consumers are being given the right to know the risks from alcohol on a number of issues. So, for example, a warning about not drinking in pregnancy, a warning about the link between alcohol and cancer, and a warning that alcohol causes liver disease, as well as that there'd be some basic information about the energy value in the product, and also sales and calories, and also how many grams, as well as a link to a government-funded site, Ask About Alcohol. So again, just basic information that every consumer should have the right to know. This is legislation which has actually been in the making for well over a decade. It actually dates back to a report from 2012. The legislation went through the Oireachtas, was finally passed in 2018, and it has taken till now to get actually the regulations, okay, so that's the things like the size of the label, the font size, the colour and things like that. So it has been a long battle, but what's really going to kind of come into play is that consumers will now be given the information that they really do have the right to know about alcohol, about some of the harms from alcohol, some of the basic stuff, just like the amount of calories, the amount of grams that's actually in a container when you might buy a bottle of alcohol or a can. And it's, as I say, it's something that is very basic, but actually quite fundamental. Consumers do have the right to know what it is that they're actually, you know, possibly going to consume.
Okay, can we talk then, Sheila? I'm not sure if it's something that you've already seen. Are the labels going to look like the ones on cigarette packets? Are they going to be that graphic in terms of, you know, like a little baby maybe and the harms that can be done to that? What will they look like?
No, they're text-based labels, so they're not as graphic as what you might see on tobacco. As I say, it is purely text, you know, just giving those three warnings that I mentioned there.
Okay, very good. This will apply, of course, from the 22nd of May 2026, so a couple of years there, 3 years, until it comes into effect. There is some worries in the general public about this maybe being nannyism. People saying, Sheila, like that, you know, these are things that people already know, that drinking alcohol is harmful to unborn children, that it can, you know, cause cancers and liver disease, and that really when you're out and you're having a drink or you're at home and you want to enjoy a bottle of wine, that people don't want to see this. What would you think of that?
Okay, well, you know, firstly, I would say actually that there's quite a lot of misinformation around issues around alcohol. So if we were to talk about, you know, drinking in pregnancy, sadly, actually, Ireland has one of the highest rates of FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, in the world. And there is a lot of confusion. Sometimes people think, oh, maybe this time will be okay or that time will be okay. In fact, there's no safe time in pregnancy at which to drink, but there is confusion about that. When you talk about, you know, the link between alcohol and cancer, actually, there's very recent research that have come out from the HRB, the Health Research Board, which indicates that actually only about 1 in 5 of us would actually know about that link between alcohol and cancer. Around 78% of breast cancers in Ireland actually arise as a result of alcohol use. Again, these are things that are not known. And sometimes people think, oh, well, you know, that would only be if you're drinking at very high levels. But actually, if you look at the cancers that result from alcohol use, it's actually quite low levels of alcohol can cause that. So about 1 to 2 drinks a day is responsible for about a half of all of those alcohol-related breast cancers.
So 1 to 2 drinks a day could potentially risk your life there. So, Sheila, I suppose this is obviously good news for you and Alcohol Action Ireland. Do you think it will go further than this down the line? And do you think that other EU countries will also get on board eventually?
Well, we know already that there are countries which are looking at this. So Norway, which isn't in the EU, but you know is quite aligned with European things, has also got proposals to have a cancer warning. And we do know that the EU has been looking at the idea of putting cancer warnings that will be right across all EU countries. Now, what we also know is that the industry are massively opposed to this, absolutely massively opposed, and have done everything possible to try and derail this legislation. What we would hope is that, you know, by Ireland going it, you know, having made it through as far as this, that we think that other countries will certainly follow suit.
Okay, Sheila Gilheaney, Dr. Sheila Gilheaney, CEO of Alcohol Action Ireland. Thanks very much, Sheila, for joining us. Now, I'm seeing something here, and I'd be interested to know what everyone out there thinks, because 6 in 10 drivers don't know how to jumpstart their cars. So I'm one of the 6 because I don't know. Only 38% keep jump leads in their vehicles and actually know how to use them. Now, I did actually have jump leads in my car, in my old car. Fairly sure my brother might have stolen them on me. Jury is still out there, because he will probably say that he didn't. But I did used to have jump leads, didn't know how to use them, but nevertheless I did have them there. So I was kind of halfway there, you know, because I had the jump leads and all I needed to do was kind of pull someone else in to help me. 24% of drivers say they'd need professional help to restart their car. This is according to the iNewspaper report. A study by Green Flag Rescue found that flat batteries are the main reason for call-outs. So there you go. 0833 97 97 97. Let me know, do you know how to jumpstart your car? Do you keep jump leads in your car? And would you need to enlist the help of someone else? Let me know. I'm going to go over to Owen Beattie.
Yes, well, some good news from a Kildare point of view and a Kildare sporting point of view, Caoimhe, because I received an email over the course of the weekend saying my name is Scott McNamara and I'm the manager of Newbridge United's under-17s, who will be representing Kildare in this year's Foyle Cup in Northern Ireland. Let's find out a little bit more about this competition and what it is with Scott McNamara, who's with us now on the line. Good afternoon, Scott, and good to talk to you.
Good afternoon. Thanks very much for having me.
So this is a fantastic achievement by the Newbridge United under-17s, but just tell us what the Foyle Cup is in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, so the Foyle Cup is a tournament that started back in 1992 with only 6 or 8 teams, and it was only a day event back then, but it's grown since, and this year there's over 600 teams participating, both local teams and competitive academy teams, such as Norwich, Celtic and so on, which takes part all over Northern Ireland, up in the Branwell Stadium and so on, in July. So looking very forward to it.
Indeed, and some of those teams that you mentioned, the likes of Celtic, Norwich, etc., it's going to be great for Newbridge United to be up against these kind of teams and in the same competition as them. So that kind of begs the question then, how did your team, your lads, qualify for it?
My lads, they came up, when I first took over, I suppose a little bit of background with them is that they were in the major league, and they lacked a bit of confidence and so on, and we worked on that, and they really did put the work in, and now we're competing for trophies in the Premier Division in the KDOL. So they've progressed significantly since then, and it actually was a call-out. We were invited as a team. We were up in Northern Ireland competing against teams in pre-season friendlies, and they were very successful. We won every game, so we were actually reached out from the Foyle Cup, asked to come up and play as a guest. So we're very excited for it, and we're appreciative of the chance as well to go up and perform against these big teams.
It's going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience and achievement for Newbridge United and all the players involved with the team. So just run us through the actual event itself. It's in July, isn't it? And it takes place for a week.
Yeah. So it starts on July 17th, and it goes on for a full week. We play a game every day. So the draw will take place in June for our group stages and so on. So it really is kind of like the Super League for underage level. And the whole setup of the league is very successful as well, as far as, you know, it brings a lot of tourism up there, obviously, but you have a huge setup with referees and so on. So it's just really a great experience for everyone that's involved in the game.
I know behind the competition there's a very important message that's going to be running throughout the course of that week. It's to raise awareness and to stop suicide in Ireland.
Yeah, that's correct. So basically, we want to use this as a platform to spread awareness. And I suppose at the start we didn't really know what we wanted to do, but one day home with me would be suicide. And I said, you know, it is crazy to think that approximately 480 people a year take their own lives in Ireland. And, you know, we just wanted to have something that the lads can really represent. And when I look back at when I was playing football and when I was captain of my team, I remember the feeling and the uplift it gave you. So we came up with the idea of the lads representing that. And imagine, we were saying to ourselves, can you imagine if everyone could get that feeling? So everyone wearing an armband and having that feeling of leadership and standing for something. So, we got in contact with two amazing guys, Fracas Forn and Paddy Maher, who are heavily involved with stopping suicide, reducing and stopping suicide in Ireland. And it's funny enough, when we got involved, or when I did reach out to Frax, he actually had already visualised this idea. And it kind of, I came out of nowhere wanting to team up and implement it. So we obviously had conversations going on, and they've been fantastic. We had a nice over in Kilcullen Sports Centre where Trackers and that came along, and they educated the guys on what this means. And, you know, it's not just a fashion statement, and kind of put a meaning behind it for them to stand up and to represent up there. But it's all really good, and it's great work. But yeah, we just really want to spread awareness of this and let people know out there that, you know, it's not a weakness to speak out, it's a strength. So
yeah, fair play to you. Very important message there, and fair play to the lads for coming on board on that as well. So the Foyil Cup taking place in July. Over 600 teams over all age groups will be taking part up in Northern Ireland over the course of that week-long event. The draw, you said, Scott, is taking place in June. Is there any team in particular you'd like to see Newbridge United drawn out against?
I'd like to be biased to say that I hope that they'd be worried about getting us. But we're just really looking forward to the experience of it all. And I hope it doesn't go too quick for the lads. Because like you said, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And we're just going to relish every moment of it up there. And, you know, if we can go and beat some of the big teams, all the better. But overall, just looking really forward to the overall experience.
Okay, well, listen, best of luck, and thanks for joining us on the show this afternoon. That's Scott McNamara, manager of the Newbridge Under-17s, who'll be representing Kildare in the Foyil Cup in Northern Ireland this year. Thanks again, Scott.
Thanks a million for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now, a drug testing regime introduced at Electric Picnic in October will be rolled out to different types of festivals this year. That's according to the HSE's National Clinical Lead for Addiction Services. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Michael Guerin. He is an addiction counsellor. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Cuiva.
Michael, I know there was a very positive response to this last year. I suppose, are you happy about this being rolled out to other festivals?
Yes, Cuiva, and I think on balance at this stage, it's an inevitability that you will have recreational use of things like stimulants at events like Electric Picnic and stuff. So from a health point of view and from a harm prevention point of view, it's a positive development that these services, which were at the Electric Picnic last year, are being expanded out to other events to minimise the possibility of somebody having a harmful outcome because of recreational use of drugs.
I suppose people will be thinking, Michael, is there a fear that by rolling out this testing to every festival, are we saying to young people or, you know, people attending these festivals that drug use is okay and, you know, you're grand to use it? You're grand to take
them? Yeah, and I suppose, Cuiva, that is the counter-argument to the initiative, in that providing this testing and to some extent quality assurance that substances are not overly potent, are not adulterated with a contaminant, could result in possible normalisation of drug use. But I think on balance, Cuiva, we need to accept the fact that drugs are part and parcel of life in Ireland now, and the fact that it's inevitable at this point that people will choose to use most likely stimulant drugs on a recreational basis at events like these. And it's far more important that we avoid drug-related harm. because our stance heretofore, where we have been prohibitive in our attitude towards drugs in terms of criminal justice and so on, hasn't proved fruitful. So prohibition hasn't necessarily caused people to stop using drugs, and this more modern, more proactive, more health-led approach might prove to be more efficacious.
Absolutely. I suppose, though, the message, Michael, for people listening in, and maybe they're attending the festival this weekend. I know Life Festival is happening in Mullingar, but of course, many festivals over the summer, like even if you get your drugs tested and it comes back that it's okay, let's say, if you want to put that in quotation marks, it doesn't mean that you're not going to overdose or something seriously wrong isn't going to happen.
No, it doesn't. And I suppose if there's a takeaway message, Caoimhe, to be had from this conversation, it is the fact that in spite of all the good work that is being done by the HSE and so on, there is no such thing as an absolutely safe illicit drug. So we would be saying to anybody that in spite of all these good initiatives that are being put in place, there is an absolute, one is definitely taking a risk when they are taking an illicit mood-altering substance of any kind. And ideally, we would like people to bear that in mind when they attend these events for enjoyment, that they need to take care and nothing is absolutely safe.
Okay, so when people are bringing their drugs to be tested, Michael, how does it work? Do they put a small little bit of it into a bag, or do they just go up to the person and say, look, here's my, I don't know, a bag of cocaine, and like they take a sample out of it? How does it work?
Well, I suppose the first thing to remember is there is absolutely no danger of anybody encountering a prosecution or anything like that by approaching the testing facilities at the events. And I think it is the case that the person comes forward and then the staff from the HSE will deal with the person appropriately in terms of sampling what they might bring forward or something like that. And the interesting part about it was at the first event that the HSE did this at, there were 50 samples or almost 50 samples, 40 something, in which they encountered, mainly due to potency, that people might be at risk by taking them. And I suppose that is the great imponderable with illicit drugs, is that there is huge variation across batches. In other words, not all MDMA is the same, not all ecstasy is the same, not all cocaine is the same. And you can have wildly varying potencies and so on. The other interesting thing, of course, is they came across a substance called 3CMC, which is a new stimulant from an Irish point of view. And there are constantly, with these synthetic drugs, there are new variations and new substances being encountered on a regular basis. So the testing would help to a great degree with that, in identifying drugs that might come on site that had been previously unencountered by the Irish drug-using community on the one hand, or by health services on the other.
Okay, Michael, obviously these testings are happening very quickly, because I imagine, you know, if you go down to a festival on Friday and you go to this tent, you know, if you have drugs with you for the weekend, I assume people intend on taking them. How quick is this testing being done?
That's my understanding of it, Caoimhe, is it's fairly quick. I don't know an exact time, but Okay. Certainly it would be designed to take into account that this would be there would be an immediacy about the testing. In other words, you wouldn't be coming back after a few days or something like that with a result.
Okay. Michael Guerin, addiction counsellor. Thanks very much, Michael, for your time.